Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have two very special guests, Allison Lefkowitz and Suzanne Chabot, two very competent therapists in the New York City and the upstate New York area, respectively. Allison Lefkowitz is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She received her master's degree in marriage and family therapy from Hofstra University in Long Island, New York. She also received her BA in theater arts from California State University at Northridge. Allison is licensed in New York, Michigan, and Florida, and currently sees clients virtually. In her private practice, Allison specializes in helping highly sensitive people heal from and manage life's difficulties while honoring their sensitive souls and nervous systems. She also has a special interest in assisting clients to recover from childhood and narcissistic abuse. She is currently working on a therapeutic training model to teach therapists how to support highly sensitive and neurodivergent clients to better manage and heal from all forms of narcissistic abuse. She is the author of The Highly Sensitive Person's Toolkit, published in 2020 in the United States and internationally. Suzanne Chabot, who, by the way, is my first four-time guest on the Teaching Journeys podcast, is both a registered professional nurse and licensed marriage family therapist. Most of her clinical experience has been in mental and community health. For Suzanne, the most rewarding time as a nurse has been working with inpatient psychiatric patients, battling eating disorders, as well as managing a clinic providing care to high-need populations, including refugees from a variety of nations. Suzanne has a private practice under her name, and as a therapist, she sees couples and adults, and she has worked with a wide range of clientele from both Manhattan and Central New York. Her areas of expertise also include relationship difficulties, navigating life cycle transitions, eating disorders, and anxiety. Suzanne works collaboratively with her clients utilizing somatic therapy techniques and narrative therapy as her foundation, while also interweaving from the models of dialectical behavioral therapy, most commonly known as DBT, attachment theory, and the Gottman method. And with that, Allison and Suzanne, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm excited to have you both on the show at the same time today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. Always a pleasure. Yes.
That's it. And Suzanne is a kind of, like I said, a returning veteran of the podcast. I think sometimes she just gets bored like every 4 months and wants to hit me up for a podcast in one of our favorite Middle Eastern restaurants, Karen's Middle East Bakery. So I got to throw out some props for them. But Suzanne has been a great guest contributor. When she proposed that both of you come on the program today to talk about trauma bonding, I was really, really excited. And I'm looking forward to a really great conversation today.
Thank you. Dave, you always make it a joy. You're a pleasure. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Thank you for having me on, and thank you to Suzanne for hooking me up with this.
You're all. And Suzanne's just bucking for a fifth appearance. That's why she's...
I got to make five.
She's got to make five.
A full hand. Yes.
And one full hand of appearances. So, But anyway, let's talk about trauma bonding. So I'm going to throw the question out, whoever wants to answer it. What is it and how does it develop?
Allison.
Okay.
So just to preface when I talk a lot about clinical information, I tend to move away from clinical sounding words. We want to make things more digestible for everybody. So the way I see a trauma bond is the way that the word that it says itself is, it is a trauma bond, it is an attachment bond that by nature is traumatic. And what is a traumatic bond? How can we tell that we're being traumatized, right? Or that we're in a trauma bond? And usually there's actually symptoms to it. Can I go into the symptoms? Does that sound okay? Yeah. So there's a sign. There's usually a dependence there. And the dependence is something that we all have on other people in relationships, because as human beings, we are pack animals and you need other people in order to survive and to thrive and to develop, especially as children. And so there is sort of a dependence, and that dependence is based on the relationship. So it can be a parental relationship, a love relationship, a familial relationship. And that's so how it begins. And then usually it doesn't happen immediately. It's something that happens over time. And so, especially for me, in my work with people healing from narcissism, it's not something you're going to see right away, especially within a narcissistic relationship, because usually a narcissistic relationship starts with love bombing. It starts with a feeling of this person is so amazing and they love me so much. There's also a bit of confusion because there's sort of an intermittent reinforcement that also happens within relationships. And so these happens generally because there's an attachment and they usually don't develop right away, but we start to see the signs and symptoms as the relationship starts to develop over time.
Suzanne, would you like to add anything to that?
I would just say I kind of pulled a specific definition from a book by a man mm-hmm. named Patrick Karnes called The Betrayal Bond. And it kind of encapsulates what Allison said, which is it's a dysfunctional attachment, or it can be an abusive attachment, unhealthy, dysfunctional, and with the presence of some type of exploitation or abuse, which can be physical, emotional harm. So she encapsulated that pretty well.
Okay. When I was reading about trauma bonding, the first thing I thought about was Helsinki syndrome. Is there any similarities to that in terms of what hostage individuals go through?
Like Stockholm syndrome, you mean?
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
I think what you're referring to is sort of the general knowledge was about trauma bonds, meaning that if you are in a experience that is traumatic, you might bond with the individual. That is true. Yes. And actually that can happen within a trauma bonded relationship. Like an example would be if you grew up in a dysfunctional family system and you were all suffering at the hands of your narcissistic and abusive parents, you might bond with a sibling, but then that sibling might also be a source of trauma for you. And so you will have that bond within the trauma, but then also you are also being mistreated or traumatized by that individual as well. So both can be true. Actually, that's kind of why it's sort of a confusing term and why people get confused about it. Because they think it's sort of like, well, I fall in love with the person that's taking me hostage. Sort of that idea.
Right? Well, this person's you're reliant on this person for your mm-hmm. safety and your care, mm-hmm. just like a parent or somebody yes. that's holding you hostage, right? So it gets yes. really confusing. Yeah, you got yes. that cognitive dissonance too.
Mm-hmm. Actually, and that also adds to how we can tell we're in a trauma bond as well. It's the level of dependence we have. Like, I know it might feel like strong language, but when we're kids, we're kind of hostages to our parents in a way. You know what I mean? We are, this is our home. These are our parents. We're not able to choose that. And so that's part of how the trauma bond is there as well. There's this very deep dependence and also a differentiation in power structures as well. We need that person in order to maintain not just our attachment to them, but maybe our safety, our connection, all of our needs.
You know, and I imagine too, in abusive relationships where there's a cycle of abuse, but then there's like the makeup phase and I won't do this again. I imagine that type of reinforcement keeps individuals stuck in a trauma bond, coupled with the fact that if they leave, the threat of that their perpetrator coming after them, doing physical harm or even killing them is always ever present.
Yes. Well, you're talking about sort of the intermittent nature of that. And then we're talking about narcissists. There's sort of the cycle that goes through. So there's sort of the love bombing, and then they begin to discount you, insult you. And then sometimes there's a discard. But if they discard you, they also try to find a way to pull you back in because they still might need you in a particular way. And you're sort of naming that nature of it. It's very compelling for humans, for human conditions. Our brains really respond to intermittent reinforcement. It's like an emotional slot machine, basically. We're hoping for the cherries.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So Suzanne, I'm going to throw this question at you. Why is trauma bonding so harmful? What are the short and long-term consequences of staying in a trauma bond?
It can be harmful for the individual. It can be harmful for the relationship and ways in which we can connect to other people. And it can be harmful from the perspective of like a whole family, a whole system, right? I'll start with the system and I'll move into individual, and then I'll ask Allison to weigh in on that also with the narcissistic abuse. Mm-hmm. So if you are in a narcissistic or a trauma bonded relationship, and it can kind of viewing through the like a spectrum or a continuum, because there's the textbook, what we're talking about, but then there are relationships that aren't necessarily a trauma bond, but they have characteristics of that. And we can show up in a way where it's reactive and unhealthy with one another. Across the spectrum, if we are modeling that type of relationship for our children, that is what they are taught is the norm. And so then that leans into intergenerational patterns of this type of relationship and attachment. That's one way it can harm, is intergenerational patterns and ways in which it carries out generation over generation, right? Second would be, we're not able to connect in a healthy way. Something that people ask me all the time, not even necessarily with trauma bonds, is like, is this thing I'm doing bad? Like, is it unhealthy? And what I usually go into is I say, okay, is it a harm? Is it unsafe for you or somebody else? And is it impacting your ability to function? And then kind of going, you know, under that umbrella and answering it from that perspective. If that's the case, right, and by definition it is, then you are not being able to function in this relationship. You're not being able to function as an individual. And then it can lead into a whole other slew of events. If you're in a true trauma bond, you're going to be holding on to a lot of shame. You're going to have, it's going to impact your self-confidence and self-worth. You're going to feel unworthy. It can lean into other unhealthy relationships or ways in which we cope and a whole slew of things.
So the question is, why are these trauma bonds harmful for us? Well, they are harmful for us because it is by nature a dysfunctional relationship. And what happens in a dysfunctional relationship, right? Our needs are not getting met. Our emotional, physical, spiritual, psychological needs are not being met within the relationship. And so I liked really what Suzanne said about sort of the systemic piece about it, because there is, I think, a bigger piece, and sort of this is how it happens in individual families, around normalizing around these types of relationships that have this quality, or even romanticizing or normalizing this type of relationship. I was watching one of my favorite Real Housewives franchises, Miami. If you've watched it, it's amazing. And so there's actually in the new series, there's one individual within a trauma bond. She was married to him, newly married. He decides one day, I'm done, moves out. And she's sobbing, she's devastated, I'm done. And then you slowly see her start to creep back to the person that hurt her. And this person had financially, emotionally harmed her children. And somehow she feels this pull back to him. And you can see her sort of internal struggle about it. And even if it's harmful, she sort of vocalizes this, I have to do this. And I love this person so deeply. And so even if it's harming every fabric of her life, there's still this great pull to get back into the relationship. And also the individual that's pulling you back in is also making great effort in order to do that, to sort of maintain the bond, which is serving them.
Yeah. You know what another thing is, and I didn't really speak to, but as I'm listening to this, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking with the individual and this physiology of our system, mm-hmm. especially when I see couples, even couples that might not be in a trauma bond per se, but there is a lot of what the Gottmans call the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which are the right. four characteristics that are really deadly to a relationship, mm-hmm. are criticism, contempt, stonewalling, and defensiveness.
Right.
And in a trauma bond, you're going to see a lot of contempt and degradation and discard, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I guess you could quantify as stonewalling. But when there is yes. a lot of contempt, which mm-hmm. is like the relationship killer, mm-hmm. there is a lot of cortisol dumping on the body. And so that impacts our health, it impacts our immune system yes. and our morbidity.
Yes, it can. And actually, I'll name this too. When working with my clients that are recovering from narcissistic abuse, this is unfortunately a component of it and a symptom of it. Though I will say, as my clients heal, they tend to get better also physically with that, but because when we're dealing with trauma and managing something really overwhelming, like a trauma bond, it will take a toll on our bodies, and our bodies will start talking to us in particular ways. Especially, I found a lot of clients having autoimmune issues. I found skin issues is something that comes up for people a lot. And then things with the stomach, brain fog, so things like that. So there's such a physiological component. And then it also, I think, speaks to an earlier question I think Dave asked about. So what are some of the signs of this? And there's also physiological signs that you are in a trauma bond.
Yeah, I think stress and particularly how it compromises the immune system just impacts our body, it impacts our mind, and it impacts our spirit. And one of the things I think that must be challenging for the both of you as therapists is that I imagine in some instances where the trauma is so severe, people can't literally talk about it because that part of their brain that is responsible for verbalizing and organizing the trauma shuts down when they re-experience it, when you ask them to talk about it. So when they say they have no words, it's probably because they, from a scientific standpoint, I'm drawing from Bessel van der Kolk's work with the body knows a score in his research, that the part of the brain, that left side of the brain that is responsible for verbalizing, for articulating trauma, shuts down, and the person really can't talk about it in any intelligible fashion.
Yeah, though I will say, if you're someone, like if you're listening to this and you feel that way, you can't find the words, that's okay. Even knowing you can't find the words is a great place to start. And if you can even take that into a therapeutic space and tell the therapist that that's part of our job, is to, if someone can't quite find the language, we can help you find the language or kind of tease out what's happening. So I just wanted to say that because a lot of people have shame about that. I can't remember, I can't talk about it. Or people say things, I can't remember my childhood, something's wrong with me. And that's not quite what's happening. It's just that the memory is very protective, or even the way that we remember things and be able to articulate it, it's our brain's way of protecting us. And so if you're there in that place and you're listening to this, that's okay. If you want to heal and start that journey, bring that to a therapist and we can help you with that piece, is teasing that out, because sometimes it's hard to interpret. And I think part of our work as therapists is being able to really interpret the language of trauma and how it shows up in the mind and the body, and then kind of make it into something that we can work with. It's very confusing, especially if we're coming from a trauma bonded relationship.
And, you know, with the intergenerational piece that Suzanne alluded to earlier, it's like, you know, even though the genetic code may not be altered, we still, because of our history, we're going to gravitate to individuals who know the same rules. And if the early intervention isn't done to show individuals a different way, they're going to gravitate to relationships that reinforce the dysfunction that they grew up with. And a lot of times when I was a therapist, I would work with clients who had the self-guilt and loathing because they kept repeating the same thing over and over again. But that's all they knew. And then when they got into a relationship where they were loved unconditionally from their perspective, where they were accepted, they found ways to sabotage it because it wasn't something that they were used to. It was like the negative experiences that they had were consistent with what they were, the positive experiences. It was like negative for them was positive for us. And they just couldn't reconcile that initially. So they would sabotage and go back to what was comfortable, even though they knew it was going to be self-defeating and self-destructive.
Yeah. Well, I want to say if I'm talking to the listeners, if someone that feels like they're like sabotaging themselves, right? It's not that someone is intentionally doing it. It's that they don't, when we move towards love and attachment, the way we work as humans is we move towards what's familiar, you know, and like Suzanne was talking about physiology, right? And sort of the chemical hits that we get when we meet somebody. And that's part of how that happens. It's not that we're intending to do it. It's just that this how we learned about love, you know, from our primary caregivers that might have been in a trauma bond. And then if we haven't learned any different, well, if I meet somebody and they feel familiar and I'm getting the same signs and signals, well, this must be love, right? So it's not like a sabotage necessarily. It's just the being able to expand for somebody what love and attachment can feel like. Because if we only have the experience of our family of origin, we don't really know any other ways how to do it.
Sometimes they just need somebody to tell them that this is something that, you know, they deserve better. And sometimes they can be, or what is experienced as familiar, or I should say unfamiliar, they are not pulled towards, or they kind of end up leaving, is because they might use the language or feel as though it's boring, right? Because And so to find a different language of that, that actually that is healthy and that there is an excitement phase in the beginning of a relationship, but sometimes it can get contorted into something much more dangerous and unhealthy. And being comfortable with something that is not familiar doesn't necessarily make it bad and vice versa. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's just finding the language and having the space where I think a lot of people Allison see and a lot of people I see are already coming in with a lot of shame. So it's interesting, like saying, oh, like finding the language, or maybe you don't have that language and we can pull it out of you in a safe space. It's also a sign of a trauma bond, which is purposefully withholding information that you know. Right. You're protecting this person in this relationship because you are attached to them. You do care about them usually, but it also has these really dysfunctional components. And so if you notice that you're not telling people around you that you love about certain parts of this relationship because you're afraid they're going to tell you that they won't want you with that person, that's probably a sign that maybe you do need to go see somebody like Allison or myself, because we can hold a very non-judgmental space. Mm-hmm. And we can allow that to come out, you know, because shame thrives in secrecy. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a space where you can share something that reduces the shame, as long as it's in a safe place.
Yeah, and I would think safety comes first when you're, you know, to set the environment where individuals know it's safe, but yet it's structured, it's safe for them to share whatever they need to share and know that they're not going to be judged for their past decisions or their past actions.
Yeah, or pathologize too, because I think when we're talking about anything involving a human bond and attachment, there's a tendency to pathologize ourselves and make us into something sick or ill, when a lot of times we're just having a natural response to perhaps a dysfunctional or harmful relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah. Is there anything else either one of you would like to add in terms of the signs of trauma bonding that you haven't already discussed?
I think it's a really important one, especially with family systems. It's a sense of loyalty that we might have to the relationship, despite how we feel in the relationship and how we're being treated in the relationship. And this shows up, again, a lot of times in dysfunctional family systems and then also in romantic relationships as well. There's this loyalty and there's this bonding, but again, we're being mistreated. And there's even an awareness of it, but we keep returning to it. And so that's also a big sign about it. So the way you might tell is, let's just say you're about to go to like a family dinner that you have said you're going to go to every week. And before you go, you get a stomach ache before. You know what I mean? It's sort of your body signaling to you that something might happen, or you might feel a little anxious, but you go anyway. You ignore your signals that your mind and your body are giving you for the sake of the attachment.
Suzanne?
Another hint that can kind of prompt you to be like, oh, maybe that this is something that I'm in, this type of bonding, is trauma bonds or relationships like this tend to be really intense and bring out a sense of insecurity in you, right? Mm-hmm. When you have, you know, if you're prone to having pretty secure attachments to other people in your life, but this one is really, you feel insecure and it's intense, like there's an intense quality to it. Whereas something that is a much healthier relationship has intimacy. These relationships don't typically have intimacy, like emotional intimacy, where you can really be vulnerable.
Yeah, let me add on to that. There could be sort of like a false intimacy, an illusion of intimacy. And again, I see this a lot with narcissistic recovery and those type of partners where there's an illusion of it, you know, that they say, oh, I'm here for you, I love you, you're the best, but then you do something wrong to cross them and they discard you, but then they might pull you back in. But no, you're amazing. You know what I mean? And that's part of the confusing nature of it as well. But I just wanted to expand on that because it's a big one that comes up. And again, part of that confusing nature of the trauma bonded relationship.
Beyond the trauma bond, and I wanted to ask both of you this, why do individuals stay in relationships longer than they should? Why is loyalty such a big reinforcing factor for them?
Oh, I have to answer this first because it comes up a lot, because people come in with a lot of shame about this. Why did I stay in this for so long? And I think it has to do with a couple of reasons. One, due to usually the quality of attachment that we have to this person. So usually they are sort of a primary figure for us. They are a partner. They are a family member. They are a really, really close lifetime friend. And the idea of breaking that attachment, we know, will bring a lot of grief. And so people will a lot of times sacrifice their well-being in order to stay in relationship with the person.
Suzanne?
Okay, couple things. So I'm going to go into the physiology of a trauma bond and what happens in our body. And I'm going to throw out the word addiction. And I know Alice and I have a had a talk
we
about
have a
this.
Little difference of opinion. Yeah, but we'll talk about it. It'll be fun.
Yeah. The way I usually frame it for people, and I know Allison, and I think part of this is the demographic with which she works. She's very cognizant of not adding to shame that they probably already have. And I try to present it in a way where it's not necessarily pointing the finger or calling them an addict, but speaking from that perspective in our bodies of when we take certain types of drugs. And what happens to our body and what happens to our brain chemistry is a very similar dynamic. It can happen in limerence in the early phases of falling in love, actually, too. But this is coupled with the trauma of an attachment to somebody like this. When you're in limerence or you're in the good stages or the love bombing part of a trauma bond, we get a rush of dopamine and norepinephrine, which is a similar thing that happens to our bodies when we are playing a slot machine or we are falling in love or we are taking an amphetamine or cocaine. And so what can happen is when that person, place, or thing is removed from us and those the dopamine and the norepinephrine leave our body, we become depressed. We might panic in our bodies and we might feel like we need to, you know, it's hard for us to sit with that even more so because we have an emotional attachment to this person at the same time. So in some ways, it's really challenging, even more so than if it was just like a chemical substance, because we don't have like an actual emotional attachment to that thing, but we have a physical withdrawal. Both of those things can be happening to somebody in their body, in their nervous system, and then also they have this emotional attachment to them, which makes it very hard to break.
Allison, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, actually, let me add to that in terms of why we have a difference of opinion around kind of using the language of addiction.
Excuse me, before should I get the popcorn out and watch this or what? Should
I? Oh, I mean, I don't know. No, you're in person. Let's go. No, I'm joking. No, it's okay. It's funny. No, we just have a difference of opinion. But no, and Suzanne and I have enough ego strength and good sense of self that we can manage it. We're not in the trauma bond. So we can.
That's a good thing, because that'd be a whole other episode.
Yeah, exactly. No, we can sit and have a difference of opinion about this. No, we chatted about it before we came on the call today, because the reason I steer away from using the word addiction, because I actually take it back to how we develop and how powerful language is, especially when we're developing and when we're healing. And shame is such a... you know, when clients arrive to my office, they are usually overwhelmed with shame, not just because they're suffering, but because of the nature of the relationship that they're in. And usually the trauma-bonded relationship itself brings about a lot of shame, which is another really big symptom that you are in a trauma-bonded relationship. And the reason I don't really like the addiction language, because we use the word addict, right? Because I was thinking about what happens to me when I first heard the word addict. I feel some shame even. Sticking to a few things, but not too bad. You know what I mean? But usually when we first hear that, there's a sense of shame. There's even a physiological collapse that can happen, right? Calling it an addiction also to something about love and attachment and bonding, especially if you're when you're a parent. I just find that using that language is not really helpful. Like calling you an addict because you feel a bond with your mother that's dysfunctional. Well, that doesn't make you an addict necessarily. That makes you a human with a bond and an attachment, which then causes you suffering and dysfunction. And so I just don't think bringing in that language necessarily would work with some of my clients, also considering their history, the place that shame has in their lives. I feel like it would better use to them to just talk about more what's happening and about the attachment and the bond and the emotional part. I'm going like this because we get kind of stuck in relationships and sort of talk about that as opposed to you are an addict, you're addicted to this, and you need to break it. Because I feel like that's not what necessarily helps my clients.
Well, you know, one of the first things I noticed about the DSM-5 is they were trying to destigmatize the language around addiction by calling it substance use disorder, alcohol use disorder, and taking dependency, chemical dependency out of the picture. And essentially, the behaviors and the symptomology are the same. It's just under a less stigmatizing label. And as long as we're dealing with the behaviors that are related to substance use disorder or addiction, however an individual views that, that's the most important thing. And as long as I think we're communicating to the individual with the substance use disorder, that look, we're going to treat the behavior and not at the expense of your self-esteem, because we see that you still have unique gifts outside of your substance use disorder. It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd say even the word disorder for some of my clients, that might be too much. You know what I mean? So if you, and again, I say this to the general audience, if you're reading certain language and you're feeling shame, that's, you know what I mean? That's a signal that maybe we move to something a little more humanistic, a little less pathologizing or clinical.
Well, that comes down to getting to know the language of your clients and using the language that they're comfortable with. It's like, I do a lot with bereavement support and how an individual conceptualizes death. If they say passed away, that's what the language I'm going to use.
Yeah.
To build a relationship with them. And then how they choose to see death after that may evolve as their perspective shift, but I'm going to meet them right where they're at right in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I feel like in part, some of this is the demographic with which we work. And so we also probably can resonate to a certain degree with these people because we are pulled towards our work because of our own personal background and our temperament and our personalities and our attachment styles. I myself have done 12-step work, and I feel like I can kind of speak that language in a way that at least probably comes off a bit more accepting of somebody that might lean into that language more than somebody that might be on the edge or be like, ooh, like, I don't like that terminology. And I also think that, I've observed with certain clients, and I will say that typically I don't use it with any type of trauma bond. I will usually use it when somebody comes in and they're trying to break free from an affair partner and they're married or they want to get pulled out of that relationship. The way I present it or frame it is a normalization of what is happening to them. Because, and so it sort of actually has the opposite impact. It de-shames them a bit. It brings it down because they're like, why is this so hard? And I can explain it to them from these different perspectives where this is also what's going on in your body. And it's actually a very normal thing. And it is really hard. Those words do come out, but it's not necessarily pointing the finger and labeling them. Whereas somebody that is much more highly sensitive or in a different type of trauma bond even, or a different circumstance, that might actually add to their shame. So I think it's really important to look at, and actually, if people are listening and they're like, oh, I actually resonate with this language more than this language or vice versa, that can help them kind of tease away, if they're considering therapy, what kind of therapist they might be looking for, because they need to have somebody that can really use the language and resonate with them. Mm-hmm. It's really good to have different perspectives.
I think it is too. We witness different perspectives. We learn from those perspectives, and it just makes us more informed. It makes us more compassionate human beings, and it establishes a norm of active listening and respect, which we want to model for our clients. So we need to model that with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, can I add too about why I really move away from pathologizing language, especially for highly sensitive people? It is because of our highly sensitive nature and sort of our experience of being in the world, especially if you don't know you're highly sensitive and your nervous system is rewired differently, there is a deep, deep sense that there is something deeply wrong with you. And they a lot of times cannot put their finger on what it is. They just have this deep sense that there is something very wrong with me. And I've had a few clients come in and they're like, tell me who I am. All right, I'm ready to hear what a terrible person I am. And so again, that's why I'm so cautious around shame, because there's a part of them, and I think because of the trauma bond, they're sort of used to that quality of relationship where they are devalued or told how terrible they are, or they're not doing a good job, or they're not a good parent, they're not a good partner. And so I know that there's such a vulnerability there. And that's why I'm like very cautious about language, because that's what they're used to in relationship as well. And part of my work too, and I imagine for Suzanne too, is for clients to have a different type of relational experience with somebody. And so sometimes clients come in thinking, well, this is what's going to happen. And my partner has been telling me how awful and terrible I am, and so is my mother. And so, all right, here it is, and I'm going to get fixed. And so that's actually not what the work is about. And so that's why I'm really, really cautious about using that type of language, again, to really address the shame in a way that's going to be most helpful to the client.
We can't forget the humanistic approach in human services.
Yeah, we're human, of course. Well, I know we forget occasionally. I forget too, but I'm like, you know, it's like a practice. Like, I'm a person. Okay, got it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we didn't come into this world to live a perfect human experience. It's you know, we're going to have clients that are going to kind of awaken unresolved issues within ourselves, and that's a time that we can take a deep look at it. Mm-hmm. Go to supervision, go to peer supervision, work it out. You know, if need be, we go to therapy ourselves. And the best therapists mm-hmm. I know are in therapy or have been in therapy. It's important for us to be aware of our limitations and transcend those. But mm-hmm. Suzanne mentioned something about highly sensitive people. I wanted to ask you mm-hmm. specifically, Allison.
Yeah.
How does a therapist help highly sensitive persons effectively distinguish between expressions of their inborn sensitivity and past traumas? And this was inspired by your book.
Yeah, no, thank you. No, and I really appreciate this question. So yeah, he's referencing my book, The Highly Sensitive Person's Toolkit. And so there is a section that with a little self-test that you can take and basically is differentiating between the highly sensitive person trait versus a trauma response, which are actually sometimes two different things sometimes, but sometimes they could be a little mixed together. And so what the self-test does, it basically breaks down trauma symptoms versus the HSP trait, which there can be a little overlap. And so the way that I work with people, the way I express it in the test, is finding out sort of what is just pieces of the trait versus sort of your preferences and sort of your nervous system, and then versus sort of what is the trauma. And the way that we learn that is I get to know about you. I get to know about your trauma. I also get to learn about your nervous system and your nervous system preferences. And as we start to tell those two stories and sort that through, we can kind of tease out what is what. And occasionally there is overlap. So like an example might be a highly sensitive person, when they enter a room, they might scan the room. They might look around to say, okay, and they're thinking, where might I want to sit? Where might I, you know, I might want to sit near a window. I might want to sit near some place I get some air. Oh, that person, you know, over there looks kind of nice. I don't know anybody. Maybe I'll go sit next to them. Maybe I want to be close to the speaker. So we're sort of thinking about all those different elements, right? And so we're sort of looking, we're scanning for comfort and a little bit of safety, right? Someone that's maybe coming from the lens of trauma would be scanning the room for safety reasons. So they're saying, is something in this room that might be dangerous or harmful for me? What if I need to get out? Where are the exit doors? Is there anybody here that feels like might harm me? Right. And so both of those might appear as a form of hypervigilance of scanning and looking and checking for safety. Right. And so by getting to know the person, we can kind of differentiate, okay, is this urge from a place of just being a HSP, being able to scan the environment, see we might be more comfortable, or are we checking for safety and threat and, you know what I mean, things that might be harmful. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of an example of that, about how to tease out what is the trait or what could be a trauma response.
Thank you for that, Allison. And of course, I want to give Suzanne an opportunity to fill in. Mm-hmm. So Suzanne, it's on you.
Oh, I don't have anything to add other than I am thinking about a specific client of mine that this could really be helpful. Mm. So I would talk to you after about that situation.
Yeah.
I have a little peer supervision.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that has always been a kind of a pet peeve of mine, especially with empaths or highly sensitive persons, you know, I know in your book, and you've mentioned that there are some HSPs who are actually ADHD. But there are also a lot of individuals who are HSPs who get misdiagnosed because the therapist doesn't take the time to see how they relate to the world, to see what stimuli they're more sensitive to. And I think HSPs also think very multidimensionally. They're very intuitive. And they can be all over the place at the same time, but yet they eventually come around and it, you know, works out. But you have to understand how they see the world. And a lot of times, I think therapists, not all therapists, but some may be too quick to diagnose without finding the context towards how the individual sees their world.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's why, you know, learning about any forms of neurodivergency is so incredibly important, because, and that's also sort of the flaw of the DSM, not all brains are the same, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of having that level of awareness with your clients and also the therapist awareness that there's different types of brains and we have different types of preferences. And preference doesn't necessarily mean disorder, you know, right. And being able to tell the difference for the person.
Absolutely. All right. I would ask either one of you can answer this. You can answer it at the same time in stereo. Doesn't matter.
Okay.
How do therapists help individuals break free from the trauma bond? What are some suggestions that you have as therapists to break free from that?
Suzanne, do you want to go first? I'm
going to say, well, I was thinking about this through the lens once again of like a true trauma bond when I see an individual perhaps that's in a relationship like this, and also maybe a couple that is sort of, you know, they have some toxicity going on, but not necessarily a trauma bond. I kind of outlined it in a similar way, but under like the same kind of formula that I would probably use, but in different ways, depending on the context and the situation. And so that would be, first would be insight and acceptance. So if somebody's in a trauma bond, it's a matter of really discerning what is going on, like the information, and then their acceptance of that. Because a lot of times, even at any point on that continuum, people need to accept the reality of what is going on. And then what are they going to do with that reality, right? Then what would the change be? And so then that definitely shifts depending on who I'm working with. I actually find that some people that are in a trauma-bonded relationship might not get past the insight. They just might not. And it's a matter of coping with what was going on. Or they might accept it to a degree, but they might not want to really change the relationship. They might just have to cope with whatever the dynamics are. I can get into examples of that, but I want to let Allison go. And then the change, you know, is willingness with a couple. I'll stick with couples for now. The willingness to stretch. At what point, you know, the majority of couples, this is a little statistic, the majority of couples' problems, about close to 70% are perpetual issues, which just means that they're not something that are totally fixable or solvable. And so it's like a matter of what kind of problems am I willing to face with this person, and what level of discomfort am I willing to face? That's part of the acceptance of the reality. And sometimes that can be ways in which we expect somebody to change, holding ourselves accountable for our behavior, because we're expecting something that is, you know, impossible for somebody to do for us. And we might be approaching that in a very unhealthy way. And we're also probably responding to certain attachment wounds. And, you know, sometimes we can overcompensate or be hypervigilant to somebody abandoning us before they actually do that. And there is the level of managing shame and grandiosity, meaning we can shame ourselves and bring ourselves down. We could be grandiose and contemptuous and put the other person down, and working with that with a couple. So, and then there's just coping with our own nervous systems, which is with both types of scenarios across the whole continuum, being able to, if we're dysregulated or activated, how can we cope with that relationally and then independent of another person? I'll let Allison weigh in.
Yeah, it's a meaty question because there's a lot to do. The question, again, I'm just going to repeat, is how do therapists help individuals break free from the trauma bond, right? And so the way that we do that is at first sort of normalize and reduce shame about what's happening. I feel like that's the first piece because, again, everyone comes in with a lot of shame about it. And then the way that I'd like to summarize the way that I work with it is actually a little formula that I came up with a little while ago. And basically the formula is, and I'll explain it first of sort of where it comes from, because when we're in trauma bonds or dysfunctional relationships or narcissist relationships, we move away from our intuition. We also move away from being able to observe signals that our mind and body give us and being able to trust those as information about how we'd like to proceed in a relationship. And so if those things get damaged within a trauma bond or a dysfunctional or narcissistic relationship, there's sort of a little formula I came up with. So basically it's attunement plus discernment equals intuition, which is sort of the key for recognizing whether you're in a trauma-bonded relationship or not. So when I say attunement, I mean attuning to the body, all the signs and signals that our body might be giving us that we're indeed in a trauma-bonded relationship. So that could be the confusion, the brain fog, the physiological, the stomach aches we get before we see them. Also, you know, we talked about earlier about autoimmune diseases and things like that that might pop up if we're in a trauma-bonded dysfunctional relationship. So that's one. And also attuning to the body and knowing that the body is sending a signal and honoring that. The second one is discernment, so working with the mind. And so being able to sort of discern our own thoughts and experiences, and especially I say for HSPs, because we tend to have a deep, rich inner life. We tend to think deeply. We have a lot going on in our minds and our brains. And so being able to discern what is the language of our intuition versus what is the language of dysfunction and trauma that we have absorbed from the person that we're in the dysfunctional relationship with. So you'll see this in dysfunctional relationships. It'll sort of be the voice of the harmful mother and father in this person's head that's sort of also maintaining that bond there as well. And so if we're able to clear the path of the attunement with the body that sends signs and signals, clear the path of discernment of the mind, being able to distinguish what is my thought versus the thought of the abusive or dysfunctional people that have been harmful to me, then I can reconnect with my intuition, which is sort of down here. I always think that intuition lives in the belly somewhere. And then if we kind of have a clear path, then we can listen to our minds and bodies more and develop better and more functional and healthier relationships. And so that's sort of how we get there. There's a lot more in there. There's a lot layered. I think that's why it's hard to answer the question, because it's sort of a little journey that we go on with our clients to get to the other side. But I've seen many, many people do it. And it's absolutely possible for you to heal from a trauma-bonded relationship.
Well, I think both you and Suzanne gave our listeners some good food for thought in terms of steps that they can take with the help of a great therapist to break free of that trauma bond. One of my last questions for the both of you, and I'll start with, is I'm going to ask you both to, if you could leave our listeners with one takeaway today, what would that be? And Suzanne, I'll start with you first.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about discernment, but slightly in a different way, being able to say, you know, being able to identify if this is a trauma bond or not. And being able to say, okay, if I can't quite do this, if I can't quite figure it out, then maybe I need to resource myself out. And then regardless of whether or not it's a trauma bond, I want to leave just a little saying or a little quote, which I came up with when I was jotting down my notes, which is, it does not need to be a trauma bond to be worked upon. So I want you to remember that, is even if it's not a trauma bond, if you're questioning it, right, if there's something in there rattling around in your brain, then it probably there needs work to be done within the relationship or some stuff within you. And so that's all I have to say about that.
Allison?
Yeah. So I guess I'm going to go back to my favorite topic, which is reducing shame. And so, because it's so important. It's such a powerful tool.
Yeah.
And so what I'd leave with the listeners is no one enters a trauma-bonded relationship consciously. So if you find yourself in one, please forgive yourself. You're a human being just trying to attach, and we all need attachment. And so just to normalize that for yourself, and as best you can, try not to shame yourself for it, and or please bring it to a therapist's office and we can help dissolve it for you, because there's no need for it.
Those are both great takeaways. So thank you both for that. And my last question for you today is, if people want to get in touch with you, find out about your services, and in Allison's case, find out how to purchase her book, what's the best way to do that? Allison, I'll start with you, and then we'll end with Suzanne.
Sure. You can find my book. It's been out since 2020, so it's all over the place. Any major booksellers, I think it's in a bunch of independent used bookshops at this point. So if you literally Google Highly Sensitive Persons Toolkit, you'll get a lot of different options. And I think it's being sold in different countries. So if you're listening from another country as well, I would just say, check out your country's main version of Amazon. It should be able to be found there. If you want to reach me, you can reach me at my website, which is almft.com. And you can send me a message on there. I also have a super neglected TikTok that I must go back to. And it's called, it's hard to do social media, my goodness. It's a lot of work. It's a Highly Sensitive Human at TikTok. So I've got a few posts that with some helpful information, and I intend to go back to it. So any of those are a great way to reach me.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Last but certainly not least, Suzanne.
I'm just going to give my website. And on that website, all of my links are available on there and my contact information. That is heartinhandtherapy.com. And heart is spelled H-E-A-R-T, in hand, heartinhandtherapy.com.
For those of you on YouTube, you will see the visual with the heart with Suzanne. So make sure you tune in on YouTube just for that. So, but anyway, I had a blast talking to both the Allison and Suzanne. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. And I hope we could do this again in the future, either singularly or together.
Yeah, definitely. That would be fun. This was fun.
Yeah, it felt like it was hard to be abbreviated, but it was great. I'm glad we were able to do it.
And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.